Australia's military history is more than just a collection of dates and the locations of war-ravaged battlefields. It is the stories of service and sacrifice of those who have answered the call of their country of birth or adoption and the enduring legacy they have created. Join me as we look into one of those stories. I'm your host, Ross Manuel, and welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, a Doc Network podcast. Now let's get started. G'day folks and welcome to episode 69 of the podcast recorded on the 30th of April 2024. This is the second episode and part two of an ongoing series made in partnership with History Guild. Now under normal circumstances, now would be the time that I would send you to check out our website or web store to pick out one of our awesome morale patches, but instead I recommend you check out historyguild.org and check out the hundreds of articles dedicated to educating people about Australia's contributions to battles in Greece, Crete, and Malta. So join me as I give you part two of the life, service, and legacy of an officer who served in both Greece and Crete, William Holmes Travers. Let's get started. Last episode, I introduced you to William Holmes Travers. He was born the 9th of November 1915 in Neutral Bay, New South Wales. Known as Bill to his family, he was an indent agent for Lever Brothers, while volunteering for overseas service with the Australian Imperial Force as an original member of the 2nd 1st Australian Infantry Battalion. He would marry Jean Margaret Evelyn Mackay, the daughter of the commander of the 6th Australian Division, Major General Ivan Mackay, just prior to departing for overseas service. He served throughout the battalion's involvement in the North African campaign, including the captures of Bardia and Tobruk, before serving as part of the rearguard action during the disastrous British campaign in Greece. Now, as we continue the story of Bill Travers, we join him and the other survivors of the 2nd 1st on a convoy of warships and troop transports headed for the tiny island of Crete. While most of the 2nd 1st travelled aboard the troop ship SS Thurland Castle, Travers travelled aboard the comparative luxury of the British destroyer HMS Rhinek. One thing that was synonymous with the evacuation of Greece was that Travers would have had to have foregone any personal belongings. All he could bring with him was what military equipment he had, and according to Travers in a 2003 interview was considerable, as in his own words, the 2nd 1st as a unit did not conduct any major fighting while on Greece, and as a result were fully equipped. Shortly after embarking aboard the Rhinek, Travers and the rest of the survivors of the second raising of the Anzac Corps disembarked in Crete at the main port of Suda Bay while under the fire of German aircraft. Once disembarking, they rested at a refreshment camp for the evening. The following morning, they set off for Calabes, 12 miles away, taking a position facing east astride two roads in the Retimo defensive perimeter, ready to repulse any German thrust along the road north. Initially deemed strategically vital to Britain in October 1940 and then classified a strategic threat to the Germans shortly afterwards, Crete boasted three airfields and a port, which enabled the Royal Navy to operate in the eastern Mediterranean and facilitated emergency landing sites for the Royal Air Force as they conducted strikes on German positions in southern Europe, particularly the crucial Romanian oil fields. However, by April 1941, the island's strategic significance had dwindled to non-existence. Its lack of adequate road and rail infrastructure hampered troop movements, while the outdated port facilities hindered the swift resupply or evacuation efforts. Despite British forces occupying the island since October, no substantial actions had been taken to do anything with it, and according to the Australian official historian for the Second World War, Gavin Long, quote, "Although the possibility of an evacuation from Greece had been in the mind since early in March, plans and preparations to defend Crete against a major attack were not initiated until the middle of April. Much that could have been done in the meantime remained undone," unquote. Consequently, the defending force on Crete, as of the 26th of April 1941, comprised predominantly of two-thirds of the New Zealand Division under the command of Major General Bernard Freyberg, VC, alongside an amalgamated unit of the 19th and 17th Australian Infantry Brigades, consolidated as the 19th Australian Brigade Group under the command of Major General George Vasey. However, they faced critical shortages of essential equipment and supplies, which left them inadequately provisioned. There was artillerymen with no guns, signalers with no signal equipment, transport drivers with no vehicles, and troops with no training. Recognizing the dire situation they were in, the remaining survivors from Greece were redirected to Alexandria due to the island's limited stockpiles. Already on the island was a British brigade that had been garrisoned there since the start of the war and supplemented by approximately 13 Greek battalions. These Greek units comprised a mixture of mainland evacuees and green recruits with minimal training and scant equipment, and they lacked sufficient ammunition for the coming fight. In total, approximately 39,000 British and Dominion troops defended the island and dug in to brace themselves for the imminent German assault. On the 30th of April, Travers and the rest of the 2nd First was moved to defensive positions around the Retimo Aerodrome with orders to defend it to the last. Although, according to the men of the 2nd First, to call the narrow strip of land only suitable for fighters and light aircraft an aerodrome was an insult to aerodromes. While they occupied these positions, the battalion heard the tragic news that the HMS Rhinek, whose crew had befriended the men of the 2nd First and treated them with hospitality, had been sunk with heavy casualties while coming to the aid of stricken troop transports. Their mood, however, was improved with the news that the missing B Company, which had become separated from the rest of the battalion during the evacuation, had been recovered with no casualties, but unfortunately lacked all of their equipment. As the troops dug into defensive positions around Retimo and tried to recover following the evacuation, they would be joined by Captain Ralph Honor and the survivors of the 2nd 11th Australian Infantry Battalion on the 9th of May, with a focus of episodes 47 to 49. The day before Honor and the 2nd 11th arrived, Travers and the rest of the 2nd 1st were relocated to the right flank of the 5-kilometre defensive perimeter to cover the nearby hills that overlooked the airfield, also the east-west road and the village of PG. Honor and the 2nd 11th were relocated to the left flank of the perimeter near the village of Palantirs, and the two positions were linked by the Greek 4th Battalion. Don't worry, I'll include maps in the show notes to explain things. Once the position had been established, Travers and the rest of the battalion routinely bartered with the locals as the Allied supply issues prevented adequate rations and supplies, and in doing so, immersed themselves into Cretan culture and frequented the beach. The major concern, however, for the CO of the 2nd 1st, Lieutenant Colonel Ian Campbell, the relative inexperience of the Greek troops that held the centre of the defensive line, remarking that few had even fired their rifles and the ones that had were antiquated pre-war weapons. There was, however, a force comprised of Greek police cadets located within Retimo that was, by comparison, disciplined, trained, and equipped as infantry. To augment their defences, there were four 100mm artillery pieces, though sources differ on if all four were Italian or if two were French in origin. And along with that was four 75mm guns with no sights that were to be used by the 2nd 3rd Australian Field Artillery Regiment. While a massive downgrade from the 25-pounder guns they abandoned in Greece, they set to make do. On the 12th of May, Travers and the rest of C Company were in slit trenches at the base of the hills that resided at the end of the Retimo Aerodrome when a Messerschmitt Bf 110 reconnaissance plane buzzed the aerodrome at low level. None of the Australians in their trenches fired on the plane, as the consensus was that it appeared that it was actually going to land. That was, of course, until it reached the end of the runway, where a contingent of Royal Air Force personnel that had been stationed there to service any Allied plane that, for some reason, landed at Retimo, opened fire from a light machine gun mounted on a tripod. The pilot attempted to head back to sea, but due to the elevation he was flying at, couldn't navigate the hills that surrounded the aerodrome and crashed, killing all aboard. Travers later recalled visiting the wreck and even climbing aboard. What Travers found on the plane was aerial reconnaissance photographs of the aerodrome, which showed the number of Gloucester Gladiator biplanes parked there, which then passed up to headquarters. The following day, Travers recalled, quote, "The very next day, an irate intelligence officer arrived to castigate Lieutenant Colonel Campbell for digging trenches in such a position as would obviously show up in aerial photographs. The officer returned to his base a sadder and wiser man after the CO showed him on the ground the actual weapon pits that didn't show up on the aerial photographs and the dummy pits that did," unquote. The trenches had been constructed by the Greek soldiers long before the arrival of Australian forces, who instead built more modern weapon pits. This stark difference in training, using a First World War tactic to fight in the Second World War, was exploited to great effect by the Australians and was used to dupe the German forces. Australian troops, like the rest of the Allied forces, had become experts at concealment thanks in part to the presence of vineyards and olive groves providing excellent cover from the air, and according to Gavin Long, quote, "If in the event one of the defenders' positions was located and photographed by German reconnaissance planes, it was quickly moved," unquote. That advantage was also a tactical obstacle, as the terraced hills around Retimo, while providing excellent cover, made communication almost impossible and adequate fields of fire and lines of sight difficult to maintain. The other issue was that the ground that they were digging into was hard and stony, and the force as a whole lacked suitable equipment to dig proper defensive positions. The soldiers lamented for the First World War vintage picks and shovels that had been initially issued, but at this point of the war, they had been phased out. For air protection, Travers recounted, quote, "We had taken up our positions and sited our weapon pits around the edges of the terraces among olive trees and plantations so as to provide enfilading fire support for each platoon and company along the entire length of the landing strip from Hill A to Hill C. Our task was to deny the landing strip to the enemy from airborne and seaborne attack, unquote. At this point, Generals Freyberg and Vasey visited the Retimo defensive perimeter to congratulate the men for their defensive works, but also to inform Colonel Campbell that he was to assume complete command of the Retimo force should they ever get cut off from the rest of the 19th Brigade Group, which, considering the road infrastructure and terrain, was entirely likely. By the 17th of May, the garrison on Crete included about 15,000 Britons, 7,750 Kiwis, 6,500 Australians, and 10,200 Greeks. General Freyberg had requested that all military personnel that lacked weapons or had, quote, little or no employment other than getting into trouble with the civilian population, unquote, be relocated to Alexandria. And as the threat drew closer, General Freyberg drew up his paltry force and identified that Crete was going to be defended from four locations spread across the island. Running from west to east, first, the western sector based around Kinnear would be defended by the New Zealand contingent. Suda Bay, the only major port on the island, would be defended by a British and Greek contingent. The next sectors would be from the resort town of Georgopolis to Retimo and would comprise mostly of Australian contingents. And the fourth sector at Heraklion would comprise most of the British and an Australian battalion and the remainder of the Greek troops. And despite the presence of three airfields on the island, there's only 42 Allied aircraft scattered between them in four quote-unquote squadrons available for defence, comprising of Hurricanes, Gladiators, and Blenheims. In all, the force under General Freyberg's command suffered greatly not only in terms of training, equipment, and stores, but also lacked artillery support and naval resupply owing to the German air dominance and primitive port facilities. What it did have, however, was a dogged resolve that would be tested when the Germans attacked on the 20th of May, 1941. It was a bright and sunny morning on the 20th, and as Travers and the rest of his platoon leaders ate their breakfast following the daily routine of being called to action early in the morning before being stood down, they were spellbound by the sight of 14 lumbering German troop planes heading towards them before suddenly veering towards the Malama airfield in the first sector. This was followed at midday with another group of 20 troop carriers crossing their positions before heading for Heraklion. Despite the agony of having to watch the war unveil around them, finally, at 4 p.m, German fighters and transports for the Luftwaffe crossed the Cretian border at Retimo. The German attack, codenamed Operation Mercury, initially called for three simultaneous airborne landings with the bulk of the force focused on the larger Malama airfield, with the intention of capturing it to allow reinforcements to be flown in, a tactic they had perfected in their invasion of Denmark, Norway, Belgium, Netherlands, France, and mainland Greece. Subsequent objectives would be the other two airfields, as well as securing road junctions and villages. Thanks to the Allied policy of concealment and relocation, the German High Command completely misread the size and composition of the Allied force on the island, initially believing only 5,000 personnel defended it, not the 39,450-strong force dug into the countryside. The other obstacle that plagued the initial German landings was the complete lack of intelligence on the location of Allied positions, and what resulted could only be described as a 35-minute slaughter along the entire perimeter, in which saw most of the German paratroopers being killed while still descending. So devastating was this resistance that Germany would never attempt another airborne landing for the entirety of the war. According to Travers, upon seeing the descending German paratroopers, quote, "You try and shoot 100 yards, you don't have to worry, you just shoot. Well, there are 1,100 blokes shooting our rifles at about 3-4 shots a minute. There's a fair amount of bullets going up in the air. We brought down 6 aircraft by small arms fire. 6 German aircraft. As they came over, get over the airport, they jumped out of their planes. Well, of course, they come down as sitting ducks, and the German commander, who we eventually took prisoner, said, 'You shouldn't have been shooting my men, they couldn't shoot back at you,' unquote." Despite the losses sustained to the Fallschirmjägers on their descent and the questionable Geneva Convention violation that occurred, by afternoon enough would have made it to the ground alive and sought cover to commence fighting back. This was assisted by the devastating German air superiority, who, lacking prior knowledge of Allied defensive positions, simply attacked locations on general principle, road and rail infrastructure, buildings, and for the second first, the aerodrome, which forced the defenders to move at night to be able to reinforce one another. As soon as the German bombardment of Retimo started, the 2nd 1st Battalion's headquarters received word that the Greek 4th Battalion had withdrawn from their positions, leaving their flank dangerously exposed. As a result, portions of the 2nd 1st were redeployed to plug the hole in the line that their departure had created. At the same time, elements of the 2nd 11th on the opposite side of the Greek force did the same. Now, it would be easy to dismiss the Greek forces as cowards, but it must be stated that unlike the Australians, who had battle experience in North Africa and on the Greek mainland, the Greek 4th Battalion was poorly equipped with only pre-First World War era weapons and had not yet experienced any combat. And even with that inexperience, they still showed that warrior strength of their Spartan ancestors when, under the encouragement of Australian NCOs, launched a counterattack against crack German troops, and even with their outdated Springfield rifles, managed to rout the paratroopers, taking dozens prisoner in the process. For the men of the 2nd First, they managed to hold their positions on the hills against scores of Germans landing above them, a feat that was mirrored on the left-hand side of Retimo with the 2nd 11th, dispersing or killing the paratroopers that landed in their sector. Despite that, a force of 500 paratroopers had managed to get outside the range of Australian guns and launched an attack on the village of Perivolia. The source was beaten back by the men of the Greek Police Academy, who had been ordered to hold Retimo, which they did at a heavy cost to the police cadets. Despite the best efforts of the Australians, German paratroopers jumped on the aerodrome as had been a primary objective of Operation Mercury, and this was met by a bayonet charge by the 2nd 1st Transport Section that drove them off. As the Germans had occupied the Australian wireless station at the aerodrome, no long after landing, they had cut the Australian cable lines connecting the 2nd 1st to the 19th Brigade as well as to Force Headquarters, which according to previously established instructions, meant that Retimo Force fell to the direct command of Lieutenant Colonel Campbell. Despite the early successes of the Australians in the campaign, the inability to concentrate the Allied response to deal with the German assault meant that it would be all over in 10 days. While the 2nd 1st was able to stall the German advance onto the aerodrome as the Germans had focused their landings on the hills that the Australians occupied, it was a case of numbers. While the Australians were holding, they couldn't withstand the German onslaught for long. But that being said, the German attack on Retimo was not going to plan either, as reported to General Ringel, the commander of Combat Group Retimo. Quote, "The command's assumption that this small landing field would be held by only a weak force did not hold true. Until evening of this day, no uniformed command could be established within the regiment. Every circled combat group held their ground only with extreme effort and under heavy casualties in their all-around defense positions. Besides, the allotted radio equipment was destroyed, thus no report concerning the course of the battle could be made by this group during the evening of the day." Unquote. Lieutenant Colonel Campbell was just as cut off from the outside world as General Ringel, and sent a pre-agreed message addressed to Force HQ for reinforcements as he had serious concerns on if he was able to hold the aerodrome if German forces launched a second wave of paratroopers or if they would be supported by seaborne landing. At dusk on that first day of the invasion, elements of C Company were ordered down from the hills that they were defending to hold the coast along the road leading to the aerodrome until morning, only to become surrounded and cut off from the Australian lines until they're able to sneak their way through the German lines back. At midnight, Colonel Campbell would receive a message from General Freyberg, quote, "Unable to send help. Hold on. No, you will. Good luck." Unquote. Not exactly what you want to hear from your commanding officer, but not to be unexpected. The lack of adequate Allied armor or transport to launch a counterattack, coupled with the appalling communications network on the island, meant that commanders couldn't even effectively communicate with their own perimeters. This disconnection also resulted in General Freyberg not fighting a singular defense of the island, but four separate battles that couldn't communicate or support each other or their own commands. By morning, Colonel Campbell reorganized the 2 Australian battalions and the Greek 5th Battalion to launch a counterattack to drive the Germans back into the sea. The 2nd 11th was successful in its attack, but the 2nd 1st was bogged down due to heavy German fire. Sadly, the 5th Greek Battalion also failed to materialize. C Company was tasked with conducting a fighting patrol along the coast to keep an eye out for German positions within the perimeter. From the moment the German troops landed, they also faced a third enemy from the Commonwealth and Greek troops. That was of the local Cretan population. Led to believe the Cretans would welcome them with open arms, the German soldiers to their horror discovered that Cretans from 10 to 70 would pick up whatever they could. Tomahawks, spades, pitchforks, even blocks of wood, and attack the Germans whenever they encountered them. Travers himself recounted seeing a Cretan Greek Orthodox priest in a stovepipe hat emerge from a monastery within the Retimo perimeter with a bandolier of ammunition and a gun and set off to hunt Germans. By the early hours of the 21st, the 2nd 11th had captured the overall commander of the German invasion force, Colonel Strum. By the end of the second day, the immediate area around the Retimo defensive line was also secure. Thankfully for the defenders, a British task force comprising of the warships HMS Dido, Ajax and Orion had actually intercepted a German invasion fleet 28 kilometers from the Cretan coastline, damaging enough of the vessels to force them to return to port. At the morning of the third day, the 22nd, Travers and the rest of C Company, along with Captain Moriarty of the 2nd 1st D Company, set off to attack a location known as the Olive Oil Factory, on the extreme right of the Australian positions that had been occupied by German forces and used as their headquarters. Both companies set off at 06:30 with 2 platoons and their 3rd in reserve. Travers led his men along the main road with their left to the sea, and after initially capturing an outbuilding that the Germans had been using as an aid post, they pushed on in a steady line until they surrounded the factory. This autumn, I Was Only Doing My Job, an Australian military history podcast, has partnered with History Guild to bring you a series of episodes dedicated to telling the life, service, and legacy of 4 Australians of the tens of thousands who served in the Mediterranean theatre during the Second World War, playing a vital role in that theatre. History Guild has created this project so more Australians can discover the stories of service and sacrifice of the Australians who fought there and honour them by visiting these battlefields. The History Guild website, historyguild.org, has guides to help people visit and understand the battlefields in Greece, Crete, and Malta. So, thanks, History Guild, for the support. And let's get back to the show. As Australian artillery pounded the factory above them, German transport planes appeared over the horizon and dropped supplies. Unfortunately for the Germans, the supplies landed in no man's land, which were recovered by the Greek forces at night. By mid-morning, Captain Moriarty had been killed by a sniper, and by 1300, Colonel Campbell ordered the 2nd 1st to charge the factory at nightfall with Greek troops in support. At 1800 hours, when the artillery opened up to mark the start of the battle, the Australians charged in to find the Greeks nowhere to be seen. The Australian force was cut down and went to ground until they heard the Greek forces finally arrive. Captain Travers was then ordered to hand over containment of the factory at 2100 hours to the Greek troops, and return to the airstrip in case the Germans attempted another landing. Now, the intention was that while the Greeks weren't expected to take the factory, they were expected to keep pressure on the Germans holed up inside. Sadly, that seems that no one told the Greeks that, as once the Australians withdrew, they conducted their own withdrawal to positions back away from the factory, and in doing so, failed to completely surround it. On the 23rd, the Retimo perimeter received congratulations from General Freyberg, but despite this and the best efforts of the force, there was little that could be done to dislodge the Germans from their positions, and as German reinforcements continued to land elsewhere on the island, and eventually the successes at the Retimo force would eventually come to naught, as on the 26th, General Freyberg informed General Archibald Wavell, Commander-in-Chief Middle East, that the Battle of Crete had been lost, and the following day, Wavell ordered a general evacuation. Unfortunately, Colonel Campbell was unaware of this initial plan, despite several attempts to get word to the Australians. Despite this, the Allied forces to the south of Retimo Force had already been evacuated by sea on the 28th. On the 29th of May 1941, as Travers redeployed what remained of C Company, once again in the hills around the airstrip, the naval station at Retimo reported that the other naval stations on the island had gone silent, and it was discovered that all Greek troops along the perimeter had, during the night, slipped into the hills and disappeared. It was at this point that allegedly a message was dropped on the sector. It simply read, quote, Waratahs, Bulleh, Puckapunyal, St Kilda, Gropers, Albany, Boggenhoppet, unquote. Now this random string of words would have meant absolutely nothing to any German who saw it, or really anyone who wasn't Australian. The main reasoning was is that the Australian force on Crete comprised of men from New South Wales, whose state flower is the Waratah, Victorians, whose main military base is Puckapunyal, and West Australians, who are colloquially known as Sand Gropers. Bulleh, St Kilda, and Albany are all southern coastal towns in those respective states. Boggenhoppet, according to Gavin Long, meant fight your way, get moving. So that translated roughly to common English is soldiers of New South Wales, Victoria, and West Australia, fight your way to the southern coast, get moving. Now, this is an interesting discrepancy between what was reported in my episodes about Ralph Honner and what was reported in the 2nd 1st Battalion's unit diary and in The Fighting First, the story of the 2nd 1st from 1939 to 1945. While Honner's own writings alleged that the aforementioned message was received by Retimo Force and that Major Sandover, the commanding officer of the 2nd 11th, upon hearing it, gave his men the option to either surrender or make for the coast. However, in the 2nd 1st Unit Diary, there is no mention of the message being received, and in The Fighting First, while it is acknowledged that the message was sent, it claims it never reached Colonel Campbell, who, acting on the lack of orders to retreat but seeing the writing on the wall, determined that his force was surrounded without the ability to hold back the Germans for an hour at most. Coupled with the lack of Royal Naval support to evacuate from Retimo directly, the lack of a notified embarkation point to rally his troops to, the lack of rations for the 3-day journey required to travel to the southern coast, Plus, the loss of life on top of the burden being placed on the Cretan people to hide and supply his men, instructed the 2nd First and the other surrounding Australian forces that they were going to surrender. To mark the end of the Battle of Retimo, written in his own hand on the 2nd First Battalion's unit diary states, quote, "On morning, 30 May, I surrendered, Lieutenant Colonel Campbell, XCO, 2nd 1 Battalion," unquote. The 2nd First embarked 35 officers and 671 other ranks to Greece, with 29 officers and 557 other ranks landing in Suda Bay in Crete. Of the 586 soldiers that landed on Crete, only 21 would make their way back to Alexandria. Colonel Campbell would become one of the 25,328 British and Commonwealth prisoners of war from the campaign. Another of those officers would be Captain William Holmes Travers. In fact, 25 of the 27 officers of the 2nd First put ashore at Crete would become prisoners of war. Initially, Travers and the rest of the Allied prisoners were detained at the Retimo Aerodrome for the night before they were marched into the Malama airfield, a two-day journey. On their arrival, Travers and the other officers were ordered to board transport planes and were flown to Athens. From Athens, the prisoners were ordered to board trains for the Salonika transit camp, which comprised of an old Greek army barracks building. While there, Travers recounted that most of the officers detained there actually camped outside the buildings as they'd become infested with bedbugs. Travers also remarked in a 2003 interview that the German guards that watched them were little more than bullies. He would be held at Salonika until July 1941 before he undertook a week-long train ride to Uflag 10C in Lübeck in northern Germany. While there, he would meet British officers that had been captured during the fall of France. In Europe, Germany operated 40 major camps all over their controlled empire, from Lithuania to the Rhine, from France to Poland. Officers and men were held in separate camps, Uflags and Stalags. German policy was to separate officers from the other ranks in order to prevent the officers from inspiring the men to riot, which something Travers remarked was unnecessary for the Australians as it was usually the other ranks that encouraged the officers to do something. Despite its portrayal in popular culture also, officers were never assigned to Stalags. Now, most Australians are aware of the experiences of Australian prisoners of war in the Pacific. The atrocities conducted there greatly overshadow the experiences of the prisoners of the European War, whose experiences have been largely forgotten. But as victims of war, they too experienced hunger, disease, and danger, many surviving only through the Red Cross parcels they received. Most of the Australians captured as prisoners of war in Europe belonged to Bomber Command, with a comparatively smaller number being those captured either in Greece, Crete, or North Africa. On arrival at the Lübeck camp, Travers officially became a prisoner of war. Prior to that, he'd simply been recorded as missing in action, and he gained the prisoner number XC4015, and his status was reported to neutral observers in Switzerland and the United States. As Germany was a signatory to the Geneva Convention, they had to officially allow neutral observers to enter camps to assess conditions. Travers remarked that there was a British officer that would report things to the Swiss government if things went up to the Geneva Convention to get resolved. Sadly for Soviet prisoners, as the Soviet Union was not a signatory to the Geneva Convention, German forces didn't feel the need to afford them the same treatment, and observers and Commonwealth prisoners realized that there was little point trying to argue for better treatment for them, as it wouldn't receive. And as a result, German prisoners weren't afforded its protection in Russian camps either. Conditions at the camp were harsh but bearable, though lighting, heating, and bedding were an issue. And at this point in the war, they had hot showers and German rations, which comprised of soup and 5 slices of black bread with margarine. This was supplemented by weekly parcels from the Red Cross that comprised of bully beef, spam, soap, tea, coffee, and biscuits. As officers were not required under the Geneva Convention to work, the rest of the time was spent as this officer saw fit. Quote, "Day-to-day activities were keeping out of trouble. Eat what meals you had and walk around the camp," unquote. In October 1941, the camp at Lübeck was closed and Travers and a number of the Australians were moved to Uflag 6B, located in Dussel, now part of Warburg. While there, due to the limited and simple diet, Travers contracted jaundice and was admitted to the hospital. After his recovery, he was housed alongside a number of British officers, and the camp's population comprised close to 5,000, consisting of British, French, and Polish officers, as well as a small contingent of Commonwealth men. Their time was spent holding lectures on topics such as architecture, finance, and history, as most of the Commonwealth officers weren't regular army but militiamen who came from diverse backgrounds. Another topic of conversation was women, in every single facet that may entail. Travers also occupied his time by working in the camp storehouse. While at Uflag 6B, Travers also encountered officers that had become despondent at being captured. The phrase being used at the time was "wire happy," which meant they'd become, quote, "down and out, finished," unquote. They'd become bored with being captured and didn't want to live anymore. and would do things such as trying to escape in broad daylight, an act that would result in being shot at by the guards. As Travers had been listed as missing in action and then a prisoner of war, it took roughly 9 months for word to reach his family that had been captured and was still alive. Despite this, he was entitled to receive as much mail as he wanted to, however, he could send only one letter a month return via a prescribed form that had to be seen by the German censor. Despite this, due to the distances in travel, it would take roughly 4 months for one letter to arrive in one direction or the other. Ironically, despite the fact that his wife Jean was in Egypt, working for the AIF and the censorship board, it was actually harder to get mail to and from her than from his mother back in Australia. The joys of trying to send mail to and from an AIF headquarters to a German prisoner of war camp. Fortunately for Jean, due to the fact of who her father was and the fact that Travis's brother Basil was also in Egypt, she was apparently well aware what was going on. Travis spent 18 months at Offleg 6B and occupied his time walking the perimeter of the camp, playing sport including football and cricket, as well as skating in the winter and attended concert parties, on top of the lectures, card games, and gambling. One of his fellow prisoners of the camp was the famous Royal Air Force fighter ace Wing Commander Douglas Bader, who was in possession of two prosthetic legs, one of which was replaced during the agreed Royal Air Force Luftwaffe operation known as Operation Leg, as escorted by Keith Bluey Truscott, as covered in episode 37. While at the camp, Travers was part of a mass escape attempt in August 1942, led by a group of officers known as the Warburg Wire Job, which was an attempt by 41 officers that had constructed four 12-foot scaling ladders and a bridge to unsuccessfully attempt to scale the twin barbed wire perimeter fence. Of the 41 officers, roughly half managed to escape, with only three making it back to England. Following this escape attempt, the following month, until the end of the war, Travers was sent to Offleg 7B in Eichstätt, Bavaria, the north of Munich. While at Eichstätt, as a reprisal for Canadian soldiers tying the hands of German soldiers during the disastrous Dieppe raid, Hitler, furious by the act, ordered all Canadian prisoners of war to be similarly restrained. When this was relayed back to London via Switzerland, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill declared that double the number of German prisoners would now also be restrained. This was then doubled down by Hitler, but as there wasn't enough Canadian prisoners to match the total number of Germans now in chains, Travers and other Commonwealth prisoners picked at random were then selected to have their hands tied together. According to Travers, quote, "And there the bidding stopped. Of course, they used to tie your hands with leg rope. Well, of course, every time you had your hands tied up like that, they had a guard in the room to make sure you didn't take your hands out. Well, of course, you said to the guard, quote, I want to go to the lavatory, unquote. Take your things off, then you'd go out to the lavatory and come back and he'd put the things on. The next bloke would say the same thing, and all day long they were tying up and untying one guard in each room, tying up and untying hands. So the Germans had an idea that instead of tying you up with rope, so the next thing, they come in with handcuffs and they put handcuffs on you. Well, that was easy enough because you can bust open the handcuffs. And every time a German came into the room, you'd put them back on. And then you'd have a German fellow who'd been a German official in England that could speak English, and he was sent in the camp as a liaison officer and arranged that instead of having handcuffs, we'd have handcuffs with a bit of chain in between them. So that went on. Now that went on for 2 years or 18 months. But of course you could pick the handcuff with a bit of wire. Instead, the German being in there to undo you, he kept guard outside and he'd run in and say, quote, officer coming, unquote. So we'd all sit down and put our hands up and the officer would walk in and see everybody with their chains on. And as soon as he'd go out, we'd take them off again, unquote. In total, Travers would spend 18 months in quote-unquote chains. According to Travers, in reality, they would only be wearing the chains when they were being counted or if a German official wanted to check to see if they were still restrained. The rest of the time, they just carried them around. Even with the restrictions of being quote-unquote chained, while at Eichstätt, Travers was part of an escape committee that was constructing a tunnel out of the camp. Unfortunately, the escape attempt failed and Travers had been caught out of uniform. Instead of his khaki AIF uniform, he had actually been wearing a Royal Australian Air Force blue uniform, which would have afforded him better concealment once he got beyond the wire. Travers would be caught by the guards and sentenced to 10 days confined to barracks in solitary confinement. As a result of working in the tunnel and subsequent confinement, he developed a serious case of bronchitis that turned into pneumonia that turned into asthma. As he recovered, in doing so having to give up all physical activity, he managed to, through Swiss authorities, enroll in an economics course at Oxford University. As a result of his deteriorated health, ironically due to his escape attempt, he was deemed suitable enough to be involved in a prisoner exchange. He had to be first assessed by a Swiss doctor, a German doctor, and then deemed suitable enough to be used as part of an exchange between Germany and Britain, though his release would coincide with the eventual capitulation of Germany in the Second World War. He would be transported by train to Switzerland, and then on to American-occupied France, then to Marseille, to a hospital ship, the Letitia, bound for England, arriving there in February just in time for Victory in Europe Day celebrations in London on the 8th of May, 1945. While there, he attended a garden party hosted by the royal family at Buckingham Palace for all Allied prisoners of war, where he, quote, just drank grog, unquote. After that, he enjoyed 2 months' leave with pay as his health recovered, and this allowed him to resume working for Leather Brothers in their research department in London for another 3 months before he boarded a transport bound for India. At this point in time, General Sir Ivan Mackay, having lost the confidence of the Commander-in-Chief Australian Forces, General Sir Thomas Blamey, had been appointed in November 1943 to Australia's first High Commissioner to India, and as such had his daughter Jean serve as his secretary. The couple would be reunited there and spend 6 weeks in India together before Travers flew back to Australia, arriving in West Australia in August. Captain William Holmes Travers would be formally discharged from the Australian Imperial Force on the 13th of September 1945 and would resume his job working for Leather Brothers. But as they didn't have a research department in Australia, he found work with his father at Consolidated Press, who had reached the position of general manager of the Sydney Daily Telegraph. Jean would arrive in Sydney in January 1946, and the couple would live at a flat in Darling Point. Unfortunately, the reunion would be bittersweet, as Jean, having effectively lived alone for 6 years following Travers's service in captivity, left the flat on the 24th of March and moved in with her parents in Kirribilli. Their separation and later divorce would be laid public across the papers in a manner befitting a modern celebrity breakup across the tabloids, and the marriage would be dissolved by the end of 1947. Not long afterwards, Travers would meet fellow divorcee Kathleen Mafanwy Clayton, and the couple would announce their engagement on the 9th of March, 1948. They would be married on the 19th at All Saints Church in Woollahra. The new couple would move to Pymble and go on to have 3 children. Sadly, in May 1952, their youngest son, John William Holmes Travers, would be killed when he was struck by a lorry backing out of a driveway. Kathleen and Bill would have 20 years wedded bliss before, sadly, in 1974, at the age of 53, Kathleen would pass away from cancer. In 1980, he would marry Elizabeth Marjorie Wharton at St. Michael's Vaucluse. The couple would enjoy 24 years together before Betty, as she was known, would pass away on the 24th of July, 2004, at the age of 83. On the 6th of December 2008, Captain William Holmes Travers would pass away. He would be survived by 2 children from his marriage with Kathleen, as well as 4 stepchildren from his marriages to Kathleen and Elizabeth. He is commemorated at the New South Wales Garden of Remembrance at Rookwood Cemetery, as well as the Ballarat Australian Ex-Prisoners of War Memorial. William Holmes Travers was born to serve and to lead, coming from a long line of officers who answered the call of King Country and the Realm, and as a result had large shoes to fill, something that even with becoming a prisoner of war he managed to achieve. While he never got a chance to meet the man who he's named for, I am certain that General William Holmes was proud of him, as we all are, and for that, we are eternally grateful. Sources for this episode are the History Guild website entries on the 2nd-1st Australian Infantry Battalion, The First to War, the story of the 2nd-1st Australian Infantry Battalion from 1939-45 by the City of Sydney Regiment, the Virtual War Memorial Australia website entry on the 2nd-1st Australian Infantry Battalion, and on Captain William Holmes Travers, Australian Prisoners of War 1940-1945, the Greece and Crete page and the Battles for Greece and Crete from the Department of Veterans Affairs, ANZAC portal, the True Story of Australian POWs in Europe from Flinders University, Australians in Crete in World War II by Peter Monteith, the Battle of Crete and the 2nd-1st Australian Infantry Battalion from the ANZACs of Greeks website, the Battles of Greece and Crete, a personal tragedy by the National Archives of Australia, Australia commemorates Allied campaigns in Greece and Crete in World War II from the Asian Pacific Defence Reporter. Greece, Crete and Syria, 75 years on from the Shrine of Remembrance. The Battle of Crete from the State Library of Victoria. The Battle of Crete from Norwood Secondary College Library. The Battle of Crete commemorations from the Australian Embassy to Greece. World War II, Europe, Greece, Crete, 6th Division AIF, 1941 from Collections West Australia. The 2nd-1st Australian Infantry Battalion, AIF, from the No. 1 Royal Australian Regiment Association webpage. 2nd-1st Australian Infantry Battalion, AIF, from the 1st 19th Royal New South Wales Regiment Association. The Australians in Greece, Crete, a study of intimate wartime relationship by Maria Hill. The descendants of William Wharton, 1818-1863, from Cheshire, who emigrated to the Colony of Queensland website. The service record of William Holmes Travers. The unit diary of the 2nd-1st Australian Infantry Battalion, and the 16th Australian Infantry Brigade, and the 19th Australian Infantry Brigade, The official history of the Australians' involvement in the war from 1939 to 1945, the Australians at War Film Archive interview with William Travers, the online newspaper archive Trove by the National Library of Australia, the WikiTree entry on William Holmes Travers, the Sydney University Sport and Fitness Department, the Hansard of the British government from the November 1942, the Find a Grave entry on William Holmes Travers, and the website of the Australian War Memorial. I was only doing my job, and the Australian Military History Podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support from each and every one of you, but especially to the members of our Armoured Emu Brigade community. Now, if you want to continue the conversation or suggest the topic for a future episode, you can do so on all our social media channels. At this point, the podcast is on everything under @IWODMJ. Links to everything are in the show description. If you want to join the Armoured Emu Brigade community, you can also do so on our Discord server. The invite link to that is on the episode description and on the podcast website, www.thedocnetwork.net. There you can find also show notes, transcripts, and photos of my various travels that are locating the myriad of memorials dotted around Australia. If you like what I do here on the podcast and want to directly support the work that I do, you can either buy the podcast a one-off coffee or support us on Patreon for exclusive podcasts, interviews, and giveaways. Each cent raised goes directly into improving the podcast, from digitization of service records and the purchasing of reference material to the distribution and licensing of each and every piece of content. But the best thing you can do is rate this episode on your platform of choice, leave a review, or share it with a friend. It's the easiest way to show your support and get the show into the ears of people who need to hear it. Thanks for listening to I Was Only Doing My Job, an Australian Military History Podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal people, whose elders have passed on knowledge for thousands of years, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This podcast is mostly a one-man show, with me doing the writing, researching, recording, audio engineering, and directing, with additional research done by Laurie Favell of My Silent Hero. All opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the speaker and do not represent the opinions or views of any agency, entity, or organization. It is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. And until next time, friends, catch you then. Bye.